Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Hello and a warm welcome to ACB Radio's Main Menu. Main Menu is a weekly look at technology from a blindness perspective, produced by and for ACB Radio Mainstream. Main Menu is also made available to radio reading information services around the world, as well as being available on demand from the ACB Radio website at www.acbradio.org/mainmenu.html. Main Menu's enduring popularity is due in part to the grassroots approach we take to demonstrating software and hardware from a blindness perspective, and Main Menu relies on contributions from you, the ACB Radio listener. So, if you have something you'd like to contribute, why not drop us a line and discuss it? The email address is mainmenu@acbradio.org. Coming up on Main Menu this week, we take a brief look at networking and how you can get started with building your own home network and sharing your internet connection between all the machines in the house. Mary Emerson also tells us about how we can go wireless so you can surf in the garden. Following 261 lawsuits filed against file sharers in the United States, we hear an open forum discussion hosted in the ACB Radio Our Place facility by Michael Lorf a couple of weeks ago, where ACB Radio listeners had the opportunity to express their views on the legalities of file sharing. Finally, a couple of items from Programme 107. We hear a demonstration of the B-Scan software for use with the popular QCAT barcode reader. Finally, we hear from Telstra in Australia about Telstra Communicate Prepay. That's all coming up this week on Main Menu. When you have more than one computer and a broadband internet connection, such as cable or DSL, it makes a lot of sense to network. The primary benefit from doing this is that a network allows you to share the benefits of your broadband internet connection with all the machines on the same site. Each machine that you wish to connect to your network requires a network interface card, and these can be purchased relatively cheaply. However, if you have a large number of machines, then obviously the price will increase accordingly. There are a range of network interface devices on the market, some of which don't even require you to open the case of your PC. However, for the best performance and the least clutter, you probably would want to go for a traditional network card, which would be installed in the same way that you would perhaps have a sound card installed. The case of your PC would need to be opened, and the card would be inserted into one of your vacant PCI slots. Now, depending on your experience with PC hardware, you may or may not be comfortable with doing this yourself, and if you require assistance, then you should speak to your local computing dealer. It may be that one or more of your machines already has network ability. Certainly new machines these days seem to come with onboard LAN, LAN standing for Local Area Network. The connection will feel like a standard RJ45 socket, similar to those found on a regular modem, but you can't connect a telephone line here. The point being that if you want a network, you may not necessarily have to purchase network cards for all of your machines. It's worth checking the specification of your machine before you get started. Now, after years of waiting, a couple of months ago, DSL became available in my area, and it was time for me to do just this. It turned out that one of the machines here already had a network socket. I just needed to purchase a network interface card for the other machine. So we have our machines, we have our network devices, and we want to connect the whole lot together. Each machine must then be connected to a network switch using Category 5 cable, and this is fairly standard stuff and can be purchased from most computer dealers. However, if your main purpose for networking is to share your internet connection between all the machines in your home, then you will also need a network router. And many modern network routers have an integrated network switch, so you don't need to worry about buying a switch and a router separately. If you buy a router, the chances are that the switch will be integrated. If your broadband internet connectivity is delivered via asymmetric digital subscriber line, or ADSL, then you will need some kind of ADSL modem. And the good news is that some modern routers, as well as having an integrated network switch, also have an integrated ADSL modem. After doing plenty of reading and research, I decided to go for the Netgear DG814. This is a 4-port network switch, router, and integrated ADSL modem. So everything I needed in the one box. Now, it's my understanding that similar products are available for cable connections. And to my mind, a home gateway, as they are more commonly known, i.e. an integrated router, switch, and modem, is possibly one of the simplest solutions to getting your computers networked and giving them all access to the internet. The settings for many gateways are controlled using a web interface, so one simply punches in the IP address of the router and a web page appears, allowing you to specify the system settings. So let's do that now with the Netgear DG814. Okay, so I'm at the run dialog, so I'm going to put in http://, and then the IP address of my router, and this will vary from product to product, so you should check the documentation or with the supplier.
Desktop,
and I'm just
eyes.
Pressing enter there.
Username, internet.
And straight away, I'm being asked for a username and password. Now, there is a default username and password, and obviously you're advised to change the password as soon as you get the product home. So I've done that, and I'm just putting in the username and password.
Load done. 35 links, 4 unclicked, 6 frames, 6 tables, 5 headings. Loading page. Load done.
And as you can hear, the page is loaded, and there are a number of frames and tables and links. Now, the information in here seems to be fairly well organized. We have a number of frames, the final frame of which is the help frame. So I can bring up a list of the controls and elements on the page using Insert tab. This is in Window Eyes 4.5.
Links S, top, set wizard.
Okay, and Shift tab
top.
To the radio button.
Link cell, radio button, checked. Information selection, frames are, radio button, checked, 2 of 6.
Okay, that's what we're interested in, frames.
Frames
and then
top.
Move back
Netgear,
to the list
one,
box
six.
With tab and press end.
Netgear help, 6 of 6.
And that's the final frame there. Netgear help, so I can press enter and it'll take me straight to that frame.
Netgear gateway, Microsoft Internet Explorer, Netgear help frame.
And straight away I can read the help information.
Netgear help frame, help with DG814 settings pages allow you to configure, upgrade and check the status of your Netgear DSL modem internet gateway. Click.
Okay, that's a little bit fast, but you get the idea. The point being that there is help information at each step of this process, and it's my understanding that similar products have similar help available. Now, as far as the basic settings go, most of this information will be provided by your internet service provider, so you should speak to them when setting up your network router. They should be able to provide you with information about multiplexing methods, MTU size, login information, DNS information, and these details are all filled in your router configuration screens. Oh, encapsulation method, that's another one. Now, traditionally, some users have experienced problems when accessing the internet using a network router, and this is largely to do with which application protocols are supported, and the one which seems to cause the biggest headache is this UPnP, and this is a protocol that's required by MSN Instant Messenger and Windows Messenger, which allows you to transfer files and to voice chat and all that good stuff. So it is quite important that you check which protocols are available for your particular router. I know certainly the DG814 supports UPnP, and I have absolutely no problem transferring files using Instant Messenger or voice chatting. Another advantage to the Netgear router, or router, as you folks in the US like to say, was the ability to update the router firmware. This means that if Netgear decide to add features or support for new protocols in the future, I can simply go to the Netgear website, download the firmware, and install it, and all's well. Now, if you wish to provide services on your network, which can be accessed by the outside world, you need to use what's called port forwarding. So, for example, if you wanted to run an FTP site or a Shoutcast server, and you wanted your friends to be able to connect remotely, then you need to specify in the router settings which port you wish to be forwarded and to which machine on your network traffic should be forwarded to. Another consideration when setting up your router is whether or not it should act as a dynamic host configuration protocol server. That's a mouthful. DHCP. Essentially, what this means is that if the server is acting as a DHCP server, then the IP addresses of each machine on your network will be assigned automatically. If not, then you will have to assign an IP address to each machine manually. To clarify, an IP address is a string of numbers which uniquely identifies your machine on a network, and certain ranges of IP addresses have been reserved for internal network use, and then there are IP addresses which are used publicly on the internet. If you have just one internet connection, then the chances are your IP will be determined by your ISP, your internet service provider, and within your network, you need to have a mechanism for determining IP addresses locally, and that's where DHCP comes in. Having your router act as a DHCP server means that when you switch on any of the machines on the network, the machine will get its IP address from the router. Whereas if you decide that you are not going to use your router as a DHCP server, then you will have to specify in Windows, in the networking options of your Windows control panel, what the IP for that machine should be. So if you're interested in the DG814, I understand that there is a review in the hardware reviews section of adslguide.org.uk. And for more general information about networking, I would recommend that you take a quick look in the Windows Help and possibly speak to your local computing dealer. Now, somebody who took networking to the next level is Mary Emerson, and Mary spoke to Main Menu about wireless networking.
This is Mary Emerson, and I'm going to be speaking this time about my experiences with wireless networking and making the gradual change from a wired broadband network to kind of midway between wired and wireless. And this is just going to be sharing my experiences with this, and I hope some of this will be of interest to some of you and maybe unravel some of the terminology problems and some of the information with regard to this subject. Before we proceed here, I need to describe a little bit about my setup, what I have here. I have two computers. Both of them are desktops, although the first one is pretty much a permanent desktop. It runs Windows Millennium Edition. The second one I purchased in March of this year, and although it's a desktop machine, the design of the machine is quite unique. It looks very much like a standard Windows keyboard, but all of the computer parts are inside of the keyboard, so essentially what you have is a keyboard that weighs about 10 pounds. So although it's not really a desktop, it's or a laptop, it's sort of a combination of both, because you can put the thing on your lap and you do have to plug it in to use it. So it is a bit more portable than the other machine, but it does have a full Windows keyboard, which is what I prefer. And it's one of the reasons why I didn't go to a laptop when I wanted a second machine. This second machine runs Windows XP, Home Edition. And because of this, it has some wireless networking and some other networking stuff built in to XP. It also has a firewall built in. The Millennium machine does not have that. So this explains some of the setup that I'm going to be discussing later on. I suppose one of the things I need to discuss is why I wanted to go wireless with my second machine. One reason is that I wanted to have the portability to be able to use this machine in different rooms. I also, and this is the prime reason, wanted to be able to use this machine in conjunction with my stereo system without having to deal with an FM transmitter, which I'd been doing previously. And I have successfully set this up so that it works quite well. I can move the machine across the room to a place that's very close to my stereo system. I can then hook up a connector to the sound card with the other end of the connector connected into my stereo and have a wonderfully clear and almost flawless internet signal coming directly from the modem to my wireless PC to the stereo system, and it works very, very well. You can even step around and in front of the computer, and it doesn't interrupt the signal at all. So I didn't really want to put the two PCs together or link them in a LAN. All that I really wanted was two independent machines which would be used for different functions. So that was the purpose of what I did, and admittedly is quite unusual because most people, when they deal with networking, they want to set up an actual network or a local access network or a LAN for short. But I didn't want that. I wanted two computers that I could use for two different things, two distinct purposes, and I have succeeded in this. When I first moved to broadband about 2 years ago, I installed some Intranet 300 software on my Windows Millennium machine, and this came directly from my internet provider, which at the time was Pacific Bell. But during the year or so that I was using the software, I wondered if there was a way around this. Why do I need to have software that connects me to the modem that will in turn connect me to the internet? Isn't there a way to use a router or a direct connection, some way that I can have this thing start up when my computer gets turned on or when the router turns on? And it turned out that there was a way, although it did cost me quite a bit at the time. In January of this year, I purchased from SBC, which is my current provider, what they call an all-in-one business router. It's made by Cayman, C-A-Y-M-A-N, and it cost quite a bit. It ran around $350, perhaps a bit more than that. And I got it directly from SBC. Although you can get information about this from the Netopia website. That's www.netopia.com. They have all sorts of routers and modems and different things. What I purchased was a Cayman business router, which has a DSL modem built into it. And it has four RJ45 jacks on the back of it, which look very much like large phone jacks. And you can hang off pretty much anything from this thing, and it'll work quite well. I have had one of my computers directly connected to the router, and just recently I added the wireless access point, which I'm going to talk about next. In order for a wireless PC to receive signals from the internet, there needs to be some type of wireless modem or access point. Many people, instead of getting a regular modem, will get a wireless router slash modem, which looks pretty much like a regular broadband modem, except that it sends signals out to whatever wireless adapter will receive them. However, since I had spent big bucks for the Cayman modem, I decided that what I really wanted was an access point. What this does is it connects via a crossover cable to your wired modem, which in my case was the Cayman modem, and the cable connects the modem to the access point, which is essentially a flat box, probably about 2 or 3 inches square, maybe a little bigger than that. And the access point is the thing that sends the wireless signal out to whatever wireless computer you've got. So, What I have spoken of so far is the modem that's connected to your phone line, and connected to that modem is the wireless access point, which is not really wireless because it has the jack that connects the modem to itself, and then it also has an AC adapter that you have to plug into the wall. Now, there's a third piece of equipment, and this is the wireless adapter. And for every computer that you want to be wireless, you have to have one of these. And fortunately, they are quite cheap. At least the one that I got only cost about $30. The access point probably ran around $120. The wireless adapter can come in various forms. If you have a laptop PC, you can get a PCMCIA card, which will work with your laptop, and you can just slide it in there and it'll work. You can also get an Ethernet card, although it isn't really Ethernet, it's just a PCI card that you can put into your machine if you happen to have a desktop that you want to be wireless. In my case, I had an empty USB port and I wanted to plug a wireless adapter into that and use it. So that is precisely what I did, although I had to go to a different brand to be able to do that. And I'll tell you the equipment that I got. They are quite compatible, but there are a couple of downsides. The access point that I purchased was a D-Link, that's D-L-I-N-K, D-W-L-2000-AP. This 2000AP is all written together as one word. And it's an AirPlus Extreme. That's X-T-R-E-M-E. AirPlus is A-I-R-P-L-U-S. Now, as I said, I would have stayed with D-Link if they had had a proper wireless adapter that would have worked quite well. However, since they didn't have a USB adapter, I had to get a Siemens, which is S-I-E-M-E-N-S. I bought a SpeedStream wireless adapter. It's just a wireless USB adapter. I don't have a model number for that, but this thing was so aggressive that it just seemed to find my access point right away. I had no trouble with it. Installing this stuff is really quite easy. Although I got a CD with the access point, which is the thing that plugs into the modem, I did not have to use the CD to set this up. It just set itself up. And then when I installed the adapter, I did have to run the installation program, which was quite standard and quite easy. The downside, one of the downsides to this, is that although they include a utility so that you can set things up for encryption, say you want 128-bit encryption, or you want to set something else up, the utility to set up the wireless adapter doesn't seem to be accessible by JAWS. If you want to change anything, however, for the access point, you can do that quite easily. It's a matter of going out to a website and logging in as admin, A-D-M-I-N, and you can change all sorts of things out there. You can add encryption or set up a password so that nobody else can go out and play around with your settings. And there are a number of other things you can do. However, if you do that and you cannot change the wireless settings, then you're not going to be able to connect because one side, for example, would be encrypted, the other side would not be ready to receive encryption. So that's just one of the things that isn't going to work. That's the downside. Another downside is that my favorite firewall, which is Seagate Firewall, I have been using this with my PCs for a couple of years, doesn't seem to work with wireless connections. I got it working fine with the Ethernet connector, on both of my machines, but for some reason it doesn't seem to activate when I bring up the system with just a wireless connection. So, unfortunately, that's just the downside of that. However, there is a built-in firewall with Windows XP. It's quite rudimentary, but it will work. And I run that, and it seems to be all right. Once you install the wireless adapter, you activate the access point, and they should connect quite easily. I've discovered that every time you boot up the machine, however, you don't get immediate access to the network or to your internet connection. So I have found the quickest and easiest way is just to disconnect the cable for the wireless adapter. Just take it out of the USB port and plug it back in, and it'll go out and find the access point, and you'll be fine. Another thing that you might want to do to kind of fine-tune some settings is when you go into the control panel, there is a little item called network settings or something similar to that, or networking. When you're in there, one of the five items, it's one of the last ones for Windows XP, is wireless. You go into that and you can tab through some of the items and adjust a few things here and there. However, again, if you adjust encryption, for some reason it isn't going to work. So I have kept that turned off, but I have activated the firewall from within the wireless networking, and it seems to work quite well. So those are some of the ins and outs with regard to wireless networking. I hope some of this has been some help to some of you. I know I've had some trouble trying to sort out what I've needed, what I haven't needed. There's been a lot of terminology confusion. There's been a lot of information out there. In fact, there's been so much information, it took me a while to try to sort through and figure out what I needed, what I didn't need. Why did I not need some of this? Why did I need some of this other stuff? And it's kind of difficult trying to unravel some of this information, so I hope that some of this has been helpful. If you need to contact me, my email address is Mary Emerson, MaryEmerson at sbcglobal.net. And the spelling for SBC Global is Sam Baker Charlie, GLOBAL, that's all one word, .net. And if you have any questions about this subject or any suggestions, which are certainly welcome, on how I could perhaps improve or how some of the other people listening to this could improve their settings, then it might be worth producing a main menu article on the subject, because I think this is something that has not been covered, and it really is quite important. Perhaps some of you who have done wireless networking with laptops and have been able to go out to Starbucks or some of the other places that have wireless access might want to talk some about that, because I think that would be very interesting. It seems to be one of the big trends that people are doing these days, and there's no reason why we as blind people couldn't experience some of the same sort of information and access as sighted people are doing. So if you have any comments on this subject, please email me. I will not be able to respond to people sending me questions about why their particular setup is not working, because I don't have access to their computers and I don't know what they're working with or how their computers are set up. But any other comments or suggestions are certainly welcome, and I thank you for listening.
On Friday, the 12th of September 2003, Tech TV in the United States broadcast a two-hour special focusing on the legal ramifications of peer-to-peer file sharing. This came just days after the RIAA announced its intention to file 261 claims against individuals for sharing 1,000 tracks or more using peer-to-peer software. 2 days later, on Sunday the 14th of September, ACB radio listeners had the opportunity to express their views on this matter in an open forum hosted by Michael Lorth in the music room of the rplace.acbradio.org chat portal.
Welcome to Mic Talk, the radio show where you pick up the mic and talk, co-hosted by Rachel Bader and yours truly, Michael Lorth. It's the show about technology and anything you want to talk about, because you do pick up the mic and talk. That's the way we do things here. Rachel joining me tonight from Orlando, Florida. Tonight we're going to talk about music and file trading. We have a small group so far. If you're listening, this conversation, we did dive into this around June 15th. We're revisiting it because of quite a lengthy expose done by Tech TV over the weekend, combined with 261 lawsuits. So we'll be talking about that. Also, Rachel and I are undertaking the big screen reader swap. Rachel primarily uses JAWS for Windows. I primarily use Window Eyes by GW Micro. So what we're going to do is not bash each other's screen reader, but kind of give some how-tos. I mean, I'll tell Rachel some things I think are kind of important to someone who's never used Window Eyes before. Likewise, she can tell me, as someone who's a predominant Window Eyes user who's just switching over to JAWS, kind of those fundamental, important key sequences that are very helpful.
We are going to torture ourselves by forcing each other to use the screen readers the other person is used to for a whole week. And in some ways, I look forward to that. And in other ways, it's going to be quite interesting. The show that we're doing tonight is on file sharing. We want to get your thoughts, get your ideas. Quite the hot topic right now. And we want to find out what you think, because it is Mic Talk where you pick up the mic and talk. And we want to give you a chance to do that.
Okay, with a few people in the room, I will ask the first question. Do any of you use any tools specifically for the purpose of exchanging music, software, TV shows, anything like that? Do any of you use tools like that? And feel free to elaborate on that. Not specific how-tos, but anything that you use for the acquisition of material that some might consider illegal. Any comments from anyone in the room?
Hello, this is Monty from California. I primarily use WinMX. And Gazelle Lite.
Are any of you concerned or have any feelings specifically about the 261 lawsuits that were filed this past week against a variety of individuals who were said to be sharing at least 1,000 songs each? Did any of you feel perhaps anger or fear or indifference or I'll worry about that if it's me? Or would any of you change your plans because someone you know was cited for that? Any thoughts on this most recent action and maybe the 12-year-old girl that some feel was singled out? Any comments on that that took place this week?
I myself, first of all, I use the usual stuff, the WinMX and the Kazaa and the newsreader now. I use the X News. You just go up on the news groups and get what you want. It's a lot faster. And anyway, I personally think it's probably a good idea to start looking for more legitimate places to get music, because it's just going to get worse as time goes on. But right now they're going to go after where the masses are, which the masses are. What they're doing is they're using these Kazaa and peer-to-peer networks. And I was in kind of a unique situation that I feel personally. I went to a website and to buy the track, and they even had the nerve to show us the track name and that it was there and all that good stuff. It turns out I wasn't able to download it. I wasn't able to get the legitimate track because it wasn't, for some odd reason, it wasn't there. I went to buymusic.com, one of their solutions. Wasn't able to download it and purchase it. I wound up having to say, well, then I'm going to go look elsewhere. And it was just by luck that I got the song I wanted. My thought is, well, I'll just get in there and get what's for me and leave. I think we can attribute a lot of it, a lot of these suits, to people having a lack of knowledge of what happens when they actually install the file sharing client, and that it does actually by default go out and share all your directories and all that good stuff. So anyway, go ahead, Mike.
Okay, well, thanks for that insight. Now, when you say legitimate services, you mean ones where you actually pay, or you mean just using alternatives to whatever's big at the time? Because they shut down Napster, millions of people overnight went to a new technology. You shut down Kazaa, which supposedly is 60 million of a total of 100 million people known to be trading files. So when you say legitimate, you mean sites like Rhapsody, but yet it's not accessible for a blind person? Or do you just mean other tools like news groups, private FTP? What do you mean by legitimate?
I probably should clarify that. When I say legitimate, I mean a place that's sanctioned by the recording industry, such as buymusic.com, which is accessible, Rhapsody, which is, for a low-vision person, it's pretty good, but for someone who is not a low-vision user, it can be a little bit more difficult. They need to make an effort to maybe make that more accessible so that folks won't be so tempted to file trade.
Are any of you concerned beyond the music aspect, just the fact that, hey, 261 people were identified pretty much by their computer? And if that's the case, are you concerned that someone could go into any courthouse and find a busy clerk and get them to quickly sign off on something that would allow them to basically sue you on what your computer is doing? Maybe you're not aware of ways that your computer is being used, either because you pay the ISP bill, but your son, daughter, husband moves data around on it, or what if your system was hacked and doing things against your will or knowledge? If this was used wrongfully by child molesters or stalkers or other people that could get your address, telephone number, and so forth. Any thoughts on the privacy issues of what recently happened?
Yeah, Mike, this is John Gunn from Wisconsin Rapids. Can you hear me?
Yes, John. Go ahead with your comments tonight, sir.
First of all, I want to make a comment on about file sharing, and I've used WinMix myself. I know that when you set up the program, and what I do is if I'm going to share music, that's all I'm going to do for one thing. And there is a way you can set the folder up for WinMix to strictly use that folder and nothing else. Now, there is, I'll use a little bit of responsibility. If you're going to have WinMix share out your hard drive, well, then I think you're kind of asking for things. And as being a musician myself and have recorded, and yes, I'm visually handicapped, but if I've recorded, being a musician and recording myself, I can understand, I guess more or less my comment was for the WinMix. When you set up a folder on your hard drive, there has to be a little user awareness, I think, in that aspect.
Tom, do you think it's an issue where they could do a disclaimer kind of thing or some kind of a warning in the actual software that would alert people to that, because it seems like from the Tech TV program and from other sources that I've heard that several people just were not aware, as we've already said, they weren't aware that it was illegal because it was so easy to do it. What if any of you think about having some kind of a disclaimer or a warning on the software that says, hey, you know, this is kind of download at your own risk?
Well, hi, everyone. Hi, Rachel and Mike and everyone. Yeah, I think a disclaimer is a good idea. I never was one that did download music, although I have a few CDs that were given to me that someone else had downloaded quite a bit. And I listened to the kinds of things that this friend of mine put on those CDs, and I almost wish I had gotten in on it before it got to be such a sticky situation, although now if I had, I'd probably be pretty worried. I don't know what the answer is, but I think a disclaimer is a good idea. I don't know what the answer is in terms of privacy versus the illegality of it all, but, you know, it is scary, and the disclaimer is a good idea.
John Gunn here again in Wisconsin. I know that I've been using a program for copying CDs or whatever the case is, and this is easy to CD creator. And I know in their program there is a disclaimer, you know, about illegally copying CDs and so on and so forth. I don't think that's such a bad idea. I guess in this day and age, it certainly doesn't. It's better to be safe than sorry than having a disclaimer up there. And how the people use it, well, then they have to take responsibility. But yeah, I think a disclaimer is a good idea.
This tends to be a kind of a war between the file swapping users and the record labels. Is there anything that any of you think that record labels could do that would make sales of their CDs more appealing? You know, cheaper possibly, or what might the record labels be able to do that would appeal to those file swapping public that would get them to go back and buy CDs again?
Deliver them digitally. I'd say deliver the content digitally and give folks the options if they want to download a lot of music to have a flat rate subscription where they can download and listen and burn to CD as much as they, you know, make it so the user can take the content where they want to go. However, that is rather difficult, but that's what I think would be the solution. I think the cheap price
theory has been proven to be inadequate, because now you can go to Rhapsody, just to give you an angle on that. Rhapsody tracks, if you buy a track off of the internet that you can burn to a disc, you know, buy a burn, 79 cents. It's a lot cheaper than going to one of your sources and getting it, because you got to spend time to look for it. You got to spend time maybe getting a bad copy, but you go to Rhapsody or whatever source you're using and pay 79 to 99 cents. That's nothing, you know. I've at times had three or four songs I wanted, just pay the 79 a piece, and within minutes I have all the songs completely in my possession.
What's the quality of those songs? I mean, are those, they're not MP3, right? Are they perhaps Windows Media, and then you have to convert them and burn them to CD? Or what's involved with that when you purchase the online music in that way?
One of their own proprietary formats is a portion of Windows Media, but as far as the stream is concerned, it's nice quality. When they first came out with it, I wasn't sold on it, and I didn't think anyone else was going to be sold on it, but they've actually cleaned up the quality, which makes it impressive. But yeah, it's Windows Media, but you can burn it to disk. The quality is great. I mean, I've got some songs here that are just outstanding quality compared to what you get online. Sometimes what people put online is really horrible quality stuff. You know, it's been shared everywhere, and it just doesn't sound very good. So, I mean, there's something to be said for it. You get what you pay for. So if you get a song off of a swapping site, sometimes you might get extra artifacting that you normally wouldn't have if you'd spot the song originally. And the quality's great. I mean, the good part is if you don't like the quality, you can go back to the company that's doing the service and say, I don't like the quality. So, but I have, using Rhapsody and having burned their tracks, it's great.
So basically what you're saying is that you see the store-bought CD kind of going the way of vinyl 8-tracks and cassettes, that down the road in another few years or so, it's really not going to be much of an option?
It's probably not, because people like to have the music now. I think what we're dealing with now is the fact that people look at music as they plunk their cash down and they walk out with an item, and they want to be able to own that item and be able to do what they want with it. They want to be able to put it on their portable device, you know, within reason. And I don't think most people generally want to just share to the world. I mean, they all, everyone knows that even if they close all these peer-to-peer networks, you're still going to have people giving each other copies and this and that. It'll be amongst friends. However, people don't buy CDs with that in mind, traditionally. So, you know, let's just see what happens. But, yeah, the day of buying a CD at the store is pretty much, you know, it's, you know, you better really want it. And I guess if you have the way to get to the store, that's fine.
You know, from the record company standpoint, you think, all right, yeah, we could sell them directly, cut out the middleman, no retail, no production costs. You think it'd be a big boon, big savings for them, plus they could track what types of things are being sold, what types of things aren't, and use that as real relevant, useful research to, you know, decide who to go out and sign and save them costs by moving things more as singles instead of albums. Or, hey, you come out with 8 songs, it's not like you have to come out with a 46-minute collection that we can call a full-length CD. So there's some resistance in that cash stipend there of getting 12, 15 bucks for 2 songs and a bunch of other filler. What we have here is a transition to what's called pay for play. That could be songs for 79 cents, that could be monthly services, more like ongoing services like Real One for $9.95 that lets you have radio stations, or you can listen to the baseball games, you can get the NFL, all the games for the 17 games for the season for $34.95. XM Satellite Radio, I think there's even a thing you can go to Blockbuster and pay so much per month and get all the DVDs you could possibly want to rent. So we're moving into that pay-for-play model, and of course, obviously we do it. So we have cable television and internet, some of us broadband, some dial-up access. I'm curious if any of you, beyond that cable TV and high-speed internet, are any of you involved paying money on a monthly basis for any of the new pay-for-play services like the ones I've mentioned or others I haven't?
We are here in this house. We're subscribed, each of us, to Live 365, so we can listen to all the music we want without commercials. Dez, who I live with, is subscribed to Press Play. I haven't figured out how to navigate that yet. It's amazing how much great music there is on there.
I am subscribed to Rhapsody, and if they can get their act together and make it accessible, all of it, other than just the part where you, the web page part of it, where you look for the titles and click the link that says play now, you know, the part where you burn CDs needs to be accessible and all the rest of it. And once that happens, I'll be perfectly satisfied. Because right now, as it stands, I had to go to my friend Paul here to make my own CD. It's pretty pathetic, if you ask me. I mean, Paul doesn't mind, but I'd like to be able to do it myself.
This is John in Wisconsin. Your comment was kind of the middleman, the record company going direct to the customer. Well, in all fairness, the real middleman here is the record company. What about the musician that writes a song, performs on it, records a song, and so forth? Really, those are the people that I kind of feel sorry for.
Well, in theory, I mean, this could totally replace the record company as we know it. This would obviously be why they would be fighting against it. I mean, imagine, John, you form a band, you go out, create yourself a label, produce your own record, go to a studio, do it, however, maintain all the copyrights. I think for musicians, it's kind of a mixed bag. It's a great time. Any musician does no longer have to play the game of getting your song on the radio or playing in a club or getting someone who knows someone to call a record rep to catch you playing in the club and think that you're good enough to sign you. I mean, it opens up a new opportunity for people. Now, some would argue, well, if I play my music and everyone downloads it and nobody pays for it, then I have no incentive to go out and play. But an interesting point that they made on Tech TV the other day, that 12 billion CD sales and the artists get 4% of that, as opposed to maybe 60 billion for touring. This is certainly another reason why the record labels will be fighting it. They really do have collusion, I believe, you know, price fixing. You know, when the CDs came out, they were cheaper to produce, so the prices should have went down, but instead they went up. Two new issues I want to see your comments on. One, there's some new discs coming out where you put the CD in your CD-ROM drive in the computer and then go to a website and get additional content, additional videos or what have you, because you own a legitimate copy, whereas the copied CDs will not extract this information. That, and now we're going to have new copy protection built into the CDs. BMG's coming out with a CD here very shortly under the Arista label, and you supposedly will not be able to, well, you can play it in your computer, you technically cannot copy, therefore you cannot make it available for upload. And I don't know all the specifics, I read something about you could actually make three copies of it. So say you could have one copy on your hard drive, one copy on a portable MP3, and then maybe a separate CD that you take with you, home, car, boombox, whatever. Obviously the first technologies wouldn't play on certain car players, wouldn't play on certain computers. Do you think they're right in doing that? Do you think that's a fair way to compensate the artist? Or do you think, I bought this, I should be able to use it in whatever capacity I want and be trusted not to share it? It shouldn't be assumed that I'm going to be a thief with the music. And I should have full rights to make two or three copies of it and put them in different places in case one gets damaged. Is the record company going to reimburse me if my CD becomes damaged? Any thoughts on their new methods of protection?
John here in Wisconsin, and I think it's they're going probably the avenue of a piece of software. I'll use my screenreader as an example. I'm licensed to run one copy of that, and my wife's computer is across the room. Technically, if I were to install my software on her computer, and if I brought it up, that same version up, technically, I'm breaking a copyright. It's an infringement, technically. Now, where I work in the local area, of course, I have my screen reader running, but I turn it off, and then when I'm at work, of course, I have the copy at work. But the key thing is here is I can't, I'm a fairly good multitasker, but I can't stretch myself 3 miles and run my screen reader on two computers. So I suspect that's probably where they're going with that, although I'm not sure, just a thought.
My thought on their whole idea of copy protection is it should be up to the user what they do with their CD. You know, one of the things that's always fascinated me is the ability to make my own CDs and the ability to put CDs that I own on my computer, because my computer basically is my CD player and my stereo system. And if I want to share it with some friends, well, hey, I bought the thing originally and it shouldn't matter.
Rachel, throw out the big next question as we get into the second half of our program on file sharing, the good, the bad, and the indifferent.
Quite the lead-in. What do you all think about one of the
situations that they referred to on the Tech TV show was a college student who he didn't share files, but he came up with a search engine that allowed people to see what files were available. And I understand, at least from what I gather from the show, that he did it kind of more as a research project to look at the technology that was out there. What do you guys feel about that? Do you feel that he was just as in the wrong as file swappers? Because apparently that's how the RIAA took it, because he is one of the people that has been sued and has actually, I believe, settled out in court on that. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, he did settle for $12,000, and yet there's search engines like Google and all the other big engines that allow you to do it. So your comments on that?
Why don't they just sue Google and Yahoo and all them? They're no different than what his was.
Okay, what things are you folks sharing other than music? And maybe you're not sharing, maybe you're just downloading. I mean, are you doing books, software, anything else? I mean, is music kind of the first thing you did, and now you say, well, that's a great technology, but I'd rather get audiobooks or DVS movies. Any of you acquiring other types of materials that some might consider illegal?
Yes, I have movies, I have books, and I also have stuff that I don't know whether it would be considered illegal or not, but I've got, NASA, audio from different space missions. I've got John F. Kennedy speeches, just little clips that are, historical that I like to have around. And I got them off peer-to-peer networks.
What conditions have to be present for you to sit down in front of your computer and go onto a site such as Morpheus or Kazaa and go download music for free and walk away from the computer and say, it's perfectly okay, I did nothing wrong and I'm perfectly happy with it and I'm willing to fight if they come up against me? What conditions have to be present for you to be able to walk away with a clear conscience to be able to do that?
If the song is posted someplace and not made available for us to download where it's clearly released, I mean, my thought is when the song's released, it should be released where at the same time, on the net, in stores, everywhere. If that song isn't available for me to grab on my local service, or they've made it, I'm willing to pay for it, but if it's not available in a pay-to-place type place, then by God, anything goes at that point, as far as I'm concerned, because I'll go find someone that's got a copy of it, not a problem.
Also, the way I feel about, especially with the way the record labels do things, is I pay for the access to the internet, and it's because I'm on the internet that I am able to download the stuff. I'm paying for the internet. The record company's already got enough money as it is. So, yeah, I'll download stuff of theirs, especially when it's not available, like Paul said, on like this stuff by Weird Al Yankovic. None of that's available on Rhapsody.
I think what I'm hearing and sensing is that there's a sense of entitlement that I think a lot of people feel, maybe from already having done it. And to the question about, which would be more fair, to have something released where there were X number of ways that the CD could or the music could be continued to be downloaded or copied versus, only one copy. I think it's real hard to have freedom taken away. We've already been able to do this, to take it away. It's kind of like the restrictions people began to feel after 9/11. If we hadn't already had these freedoms, then maybe the ways of restricting wouldn't have seemed so drastic. But now there's that sense of entitlement.
Oh, you bet I feel entitled. I pay $9.95 a month for Rhapsody. I pay 79 cents a track for the songs. I even get bothered when they tell me I can't burn the tracks. So we have to take measures in which to make sure that I still get that track, even though it's not burnable. And actually, in that reality, I'm not breaking the law, because the fact of the matter is, it's the same as using a tape deck. And if I take and put it on a Kazaa, then yeah, I'm breaking the law. But if I do it in my own home, and it's my own personal copy, actually, I'm not breaking the rules, and I'm not damaging their software to do it, so they really can't track that down either. So in that respect, that's legal. But, you know, I'll go to every link before I'll go trading. I'll go in if it's available for streaming, and their streams on Rhapsody sound pretty good. I pay a monthly fee for the service and for the per download. So, sure, I'm contributing. I just don't honestly think sometimes they put enough stuff up there for us. There's a group called Hot Hot, for instance. The whole album is available. It's there, but you can't burn it to CD. You can't buy the tracks individually. And there was a track I wanted called Talk With Me, Dance With Me. And I already had bandages with the first track, so I had to do my usual routine when they let me burn tracks.
So, interesting. 2 points. One, you're saying things that are out of print, and that can make sense. I mean, how can you charge somebody if no one's claiming possession of it? Two different issues there, but I want to go back because, Monty, did I understand you correctly? Are you saying that you believe that your monthly internet fee, your $19.95, or I guess maybe your broadband, $39.49.95, that, which essentially is with your ISP allowing you to send and receive data, zeros and ones, but do I understand you to believe that that entitles you to music, your internet subscription fee itself?
No, in my view it does, because isn't it because of the fact that we're on the internet that that's being allowed? You know, the technology is there, because as far as the internet's concerned, all we're doing is sending and receiving data. Technology's been around to do that for years. I mean, in my case, I'm paying $84 a month for a fairly decent internet connection here, and I feel that, you know, is more than enough to cover the cost of a CD.
Okay, what if you go to a convenience store and there's a hidden camera and it sees your credit card and then someone steals money out of your account? Could one argue or not argue that that is similar and that it's theft of someone else's property? I mean, someone owns the rights to that music. And if you acquire it with the intent of not buying it because you acquired it, and maybe you even think, yeah, I'll go out and buy that, but, well, I'll get around to it. I'll probably end up spending money on something I couldn't get that way. I'm not saying, of course, that downloading of music is wrong, because I believe a lot of people listen to it a time or two and blow it off and delete it. I think others do build up a collection of music with the model of $79.99 per track, could turn around and become avid collectors and buy the next 1,000 releases.
Obviously, what we've seen here tonight is that downloading music, clearly, whether it's legal or illegal, in some way benefits the end user, the person who swaps the files. Who is it going to hurt the most? Are we hurting the record companies? Are we hurting the artists? One of the other things on Tech TV they mentioned, too, was maybe even the songwriter who wasn't necessarily involved in the recording but initially put those words down on paper so that they could be recorded. Who's hurt the most by this? And who's going to suffer the most if free file sharing does continue?
Title clearance, meaning problem is, even if the record companies want to do it, there's issues. Every song has different ownership rights. I mean, people can go in and buy whole catalogs. You know, Michael Jackson can say, I want the Beatles songs. I'm going to pay the most money to whoever owns it, and now they're mine. And I can decide if a song's used in a commercial or which songs are remade and who can remake them and who cannot remake them. Or, in some cases, the writers. They're savvy enough to maintain the rights to the music, so they negotiate it with a record company, but they ultimately own it. And some are in the hands of lawyers. So that does present a real issue. Who owns the music? Some would say, well, the artists own the music. Perhaps if they've written the lyrics and produced the music score, did the whole thing, but oftentimes that's not the case. Working in radio every year or so, we had to do these BMI music logs, and they didn't ask for the title of the song and the performing artist. They asked for the title of the song and the writer, the author, who actually wrote the lyrics, who's credited for that, for physically writing the song. Do some of you feel that you would buy CDs if the artist got a fair shake, but as long as 96% goes to entities other than the artist, that you're not going to participate in it? That in itself kind of makes it okay, because you're really not taking from the artist, you're stealing from the man or taking from the man. Curious about other things that people are doing, because I found it fascinating that people are doing books, audiobooks, e-text, you know, the electronic textbooks.
I'm getting kind of annoyed at it, actually, because I go out and buy software, and you can go anywhere and find people who have Nero. I mean, I go out and I pay the legitimate upgrade, Okay, I go out and buy the legitimate software. I support the group because I want a reliable piece of software. On a computer I care about, no hacks, no cracks, no wares, basically, especially if it's going to be in the public. It just burns me up sometimes how people just sometimes will use this piece of software forever and never purchase it. And I'm always asking myself, who made them recipient of the free package, and yet I paid for it? Always been in the back of my mind when I see that kind of stuff. I've gotten my share of free stuff.
What motivates you to pay for software versus getting it? I mean, you might get something for free and then go, well, I don't really use it that much anyway. But what actually motivates you to lay down the money? I mean, some people go, I pay for shareware, or I have a fixed price. This software is worth $30 to me, and or $19.95, and because they want $45, that's too much, so I'll just acquire it. What motivates you to buy a piece of software or a book or to support the people that put it together?
Personally, if I derive a daily pleasure from it, if it's something that does something to help me out, if it's a program that makes things maybe more accessible or perhaps does my FTP site, you know, I chunked out cash, you know, when I bought Ots DJ, which is a broadcasting tool, and I take my broadcasting very seriously. Had no problem going out and getting it, and wanted everything. I wanted the scheduler. I wanted the whole nine yards. Luckily, it was cheap enough then to even think about it. Now I wouldn't pay it, but, I mean, back then, if I derive a pleasure from it, or it's something I come in the room and turn on a regular basis and I get lots of pleasure out of it, then, by gosh, they deserve my support because I'm using it every single day.
Do you have a dollar limit on that? Is there a point to where it's used to say, I'll pay this much, but I'm not going to pay this much? I mean, that's ridiculous to pay this much for this software. You know, they're getting their money from other people that pay it. Do you have a limit that you set for paying for something that you really want to pay for and use?
Most of the time what I'll try to do is I don't want to pay for it. Sometimes I've gotten a crack for it or a way of generating authorization to use a product, but I don't make that a practice. If there's something I know it's less expensive, then I'll go find an alternative rather than downloading it. Because when you do that, especially if you just go out into the open and do it, you're leaving yourself open to viruses and stuff like that. People love people who want free software because they implant stuff in the installers. They can hose your system real fast, you know, unless you have some sort of a buddy arrangement with somebody or where you get it from a friend or something, you know, but that's a whole other issue. Actually, in any case, no matter how you get it, you're still breaking the rules. You know, you're still breaking it. But generally, if I can't afford it, then I will go on and find another option. But yeah, if a product is worth it, if it's worth it, I will pay the $200-$300 to get the product. Almost $1,000 invested in the broadcast software over a period of time because I bought options and put multiple licenses.
A lot of people say, I don't know what the big deal about Kazaa is. People have been doing this for years with news groups. Do any of you use news groups for acquiring different kinds of files? And if so, you know, what are you getting? And, you know, what do you like about using that format?
Well, I just recently started using news groups primarily for getting music. In fact, that's all I've gotten from it in the 2 days that I've been using it. It's not as easy to use as a peer-to-peer. You can't just go search what you're looking for and grab it. What you mainly do with a news group is you browse and you find something that interests you and you grab it. Because of the fact that there's a little bit more involved to it, folks kind of take the effort in some cases to make things sound good, and it's fast because a lot of the news servers are at ISPs, or like I actually pay for a news service called Easy News that does a very good job. I can get binaries, or I can just monitor discussions of various subjects.
So you actually say you get better quality material via the news groups, and what about your concern? There was at one time said that news groups were the harbinger for viruses and Trojans.
Well, certainly they can be. That's why I haven't gone after software with it, because certainly by the nature of the way news groups work, you post something to a news group, it automatically gets distributed to all the servers that carry that particular group. The news groups, the quality, I mean, and not all, I mean, just like as with anything, I mean, it's not always going to be good, but a lot of it is, you know, because you don't just go click on a link to download. You know, there's special tools you use for posting stuff and for the news readers to read it, and, you know, you don't just search for stuff like you do on a peer-to-peer where you just click and hit search. It's a bit more involved.
Does anyone have any questions or particular issues, maybe things that really bother you about the whole file sharing saga, trend, media hype, however you feel about it? Anyone have any questions or concerns or things you'd like to ask opinions of the fellow participants in the room tonight?
Well, all I'd want to say is I do not like the way the recording industry is handling it, suing their customers, assuming that every single person is a bad guy. Practically is what they're, you know, in my impression is what they're doing. They could have gone about this the right way back when Napster was around. They could have taken and used the technology. They're trying to, in my view, and others might disagree with me, but in my view, the recording industry is actually trying to stop the progress and the use of digital technology.
Now, what is that ultimate solution then? We certainly know what the problem is. If somebody was to sit down and say to you, I have a large sum of money for you, if you come up with a solution that would just stop this whole debate once and for all, does anybody have like an ultimate solution that would fix this, or bits and pieces of one, you know, half thought out? Any ideas there?
Well, my thinking was have a service that's reasonably priced, like what Rhapsody is, that would allow you, it could work kind of like the distribution method of a news group, where you can submit stuff to one server and it would automatically go out to several others, and everybody that's on the service would be paying for it, and they could grab whatever they want whenever they want, kind of like the ultimate library. It would be online, and it would be it would be fast, so there wouldn't be any long delays like there are long waits for peer-to-peer downloads in many cases, and it would be the best of both worlds, I think.
The only problem is you'd be closed within a year because of licensing. I would say come up with a suitable model that would allow you to access legal and fully licensed material in an accessible format, whether it be secure media file, make it affordable for those that wish to do lots of downloading, price it accordingly. My goodness, you can't give somebody unlimited downloads for $9.95. It just can't happen. Now, if you charge them $30 or $40 a month and they really want to have access to all the downloadable music, I'd say, sock it to them, and because you're going to have to pay the freight anyway. There's no way that you're going to get deals with every label for $9.95 a month, especially without secure digital rights management. As far as I'm thinking, what we've come up with so far is probably the most realistic, and I don't honestly see where something like that would really happen. I mean, you'd have to basically provide the material that's legal and distribute what you've been licensed to do, versus just giving, okay, guys, upload what you want. For this fee, you get this much, because then you throw licensing out the window.
Okay, so do you feel then that 79 cents per track is fair, and what then would be a fair price for a full-length CD, or a book, a movie, in a digital format? What do you think would be fair prices for other media?
$17 and more for a CD.
$17 is a bit much. You can buy a DVD for that, multiple languages, and there's some talk of bringing some of them down to $10 or $12, and some could argue that's still a bit too much. So a very good point. We're getting down to our final few minutes here, so we'll take a quick round and see if anyone has any final comments. What do you think is going to happen in the next few years, and do you have any plans on changing what you're doing? Will you just change from one technology to another? Kind of final thoughts, and then Rachel and I will close up with our combined nickels worth.
I'm open to solutions. As far as I'm concerned, if a record company comes up with a great service that we can get the music we want and have it released in a timely manner where we don't have to wait a delayed period of time, I'm willing to pay to play, man. I'd say, give me a rich catalog full of material and I'm there. I have no problem paying for my music, and would prefer to pay for my music. But just make it reasonable and don't make me wait forever to go get the song.
And make sure that whatever method they use, that it's accessible. You know, for us blind folks, that's a critical component, obviously. It needs to be accessible.
And folks, accessibility is tops on my list. And on top of that, there's a firm out here, I wish you could remember the name of it, but you can go there. It's a store, and it will literally, for a certain amount, let you download onto a burnable CD certain tracks of music, and you choose your favorites out of those that they have. And I can't remember, I think it was in I know it was in Silicon Valley. I think it was on the peninsula, probably like more like Palo Alto or San Mateo, I think it was. This is a whole store devoted to it, devoted to nothing but CDs. And I know they talked about it on the news, and boy, I would go for that because it's legit. It's all above board.
Rachel, what are your final comments for the evening?
We briefly talked about accessibility, and we didn't touch on it a great deal, but I would like to say that whatever anybody got out of this conversation, whether you feel that file sharing is okay or not okay, that if file sharing in whatever manner you want to do it legally, that if you want something to be accessible, we are often out there educating people as to what we need to be accessible. So go out there and talk to the people that matter. Start from the bottom up. Talk to the people that have a say in the software and the news groups or whatever it is that you want to be accessible. Make a difference, because if, as you say, that if it's accessible, you'll do it, then we need to be a voice and be advocates for ourselves to go out there and do it.
If you want change, then email folks and say, hey, I'm blind. I would pay for your services, pay for your music, but it's not accessible. Put some alt tags. We'll find people that will show you what's wrong who can technically tell you how to resolve it. And we'd be glad to pay our money and make some effort. And if you want to download material, that's your business. But by all means, you got to give to receive. So if you find something you really like, I hope you'll purchase it. If it's a piece of music, piece of software, a book, a movie, a DVS copy of that movie, what have you, to support the industry, because if no one's paying, then eventually no one's playing.
Hello again. My name is Randy Formenti, and I'm coming to you from Louisville, Kentucky on September 3rd, where it's a very hot and humid day here in Louisville. Anyway, today I'm here to demonstrate a program that I wrote a couple years ago called B-Scan. That's B as in boy, S-C-A-N .exe. And the purpose of B-Scan is to use the QCAT, that's C-U-E-C-A-T barcode reader that was given away by Radio Shack. I think they gave away thousands and millions of them. They were just handing them out every time you went to the store. And I think they quit about a year ago, but I'm sure there are plenty of these units available. The idea is that this company had the idea that you would use this unit to scan catalogs. They would have a symbol on them and a special barcode that you would scan, and it would automatically take you to the website of the manufacturer of this product. There were some good things about the idea, but it never seemed to take off, and I think whoever invested in that lost millions. The company that did it is called Digital Convergence, and they have a website, which is www.digitalconvergence.com, and they have other products. But the product we're going to talk about today is the QCAT barcode reader. And you may hear in the background, I guess there are locusts that are, the window's closed, but it's getting to the end of the season, I guess, and they're really very loud here. We have a big tree out in the backyard. Anyway, the QCAT barcode reader is, it looks like a cat out of the back end of this plastic cat is a cord, and the end of that cord plugs into where your computer keyboard goes. It has the DIN plug on it, round plug, keyboard plug. So you plug that into your keyboard, and then towards that end, there's a little pigtail coming off, and you plug your keyboard back into that little pigtail. So this unit is basically between your computer and your keyboard. Now, the unit does take power from the keyboard. It's a very, very small amount of power, so it doesn't bother anything. And it doesn't do anything. If you have any light perception, you can see that the There's light LED at the end of the nose end of the QCAT. And the idea is that you put your can or whatever product you want to scan, catalog, if it has a barcode, you put it on, or you know, right up to this lens of the QCAT barcode reader, and you move it across. You actually have to physically move it. You just don't set it there. It has to actually move across the barcode. The circuitry in the QCAT reader is very complex. For giving something away, it really does some amazing things. It'll read countless types of barcodes. People think barcodes are very simple, but there's actually, I don't know how many dozens of barcode types out there. And this unit decodes all of them. The way it does it, it keeps track of the time that it finds each line of the barcode. And so, within reason, you can scan these codes, these barcodes, at any speed. I believe the unit can even be upside down. And I don't believe it matters whether you're going forward or backward across the barcode. The thing will know, has the smarts enough. You know, it actually has a processor inside, along with memory and all that. And it will decode the barcode. Well, what's interesting about this barcode reader is that the output of this barcode reader is encrypted. In fact, every time you scan a barcode, it's as if you had typed probably about 48 characters from your keyboard. In most cases, the UPC, which stands for the Universal Product Code Type A barcode, is 12 digits long. But this thing encrypts it because they didn't want anybody else to use it as a barcode reader. And what happened was that the a couple hackers out there actually decrypted the algorithm that they used. It was relatively simple, much more complex than I could have dealt with, but they figured it out and they published this on the web. And I think what the company wanted to do, first of all, each one of these QCAT readers has a serial number. It's not obvious what it is, but it's encrypted. Every time you scan a barcode, the thing outputs your serial number of your particular QCAT. And if you get the QCAT, it usually comes with a CD. And the average person would just install this software, and if you were connected to the net at the time, it would send the company the barcode. It would keep track of who you were, because in order to register, you install the software, you had to register like with your email address and so forth. And I think it just added to the junk mail that people got, and there were a lot of privacy concerns. So one of the reasons these people decoded how it was encrypted was that they didn't want their private information being given out. So since they came up with this algorithm, they put the source code there, and I took the routine and C and developed a DOS program that would that clock's loud. Developed a DOS program that would actually add to a database and examine a database each time a barcode was read. And before I forget, let me tell you where to get this program. It's like my other programs. You can go to www.mindspring.com/tildeN8kl/files/bscan.zip. Now let me just describe a couple other solutions to scanning barcodes. I was just at the exhibit hall at the NFB convention in Louisville earlier this summer, And I had a chance to look at the ID Mate, which is a portable unit, and it has a much better scanner than these than the QCAT barcode scanner, because all you needed to do with that unit is just put the can near it, whatever product you had, and the thing would scan it automatically as long as it was able to see the barcode. You didn't have to move it or do anything. But on the other hand, the disadvantage is that unit is I think it was like $1,400. And that unit is a portable unit. You, in theory, could take it to the grocery store and scan cans with it. It does not come with any kind of a product database. So unless you've previously scanned the product, it wouldn't have a clue as to what you were scanning. And so I think the fact that it's unlikely that anybody would take that to the store to look for products. Usually you'd bring your stuff home, figure out what it is, scan it, and put it into your own personal database. And of course, that is a dedicated unit. You don't have to tie up your computer for that sort of thing. But it's an awful lot of money to spend. You can also get labels to put on cans. These labels can be read by the QCAT barcode reader and entered into the database. Each label that you get, they're never repeated. They're always unique labels, so you can associate them with clothing or cans. But I figure if you're going to do all that, they have Braille color tags, and you can also put labels on your cans if that's what you want to do. Rubber band, you know, with Dymo tape, so you can change them however you want to do. They make other kinds of labels. And next, I think I'll just talk to you a little bit about barcodes. Barcodes are used almost everywhere on every product you buy. In fact, they're even used on talking books. If you look on the side of a talking book, the side opposite where it has the indented rectangular label, which I think is the title of the book and so forth, right opposite that is another rectangular label that's just stuck on, and that is a barcode. So NLS has used barcodes for several years. When talking books come in, or any container comes in, it's automatically scanned, and from that information, they know the title of the book. They know, the RC number. They know who checked it out, and they can register it that its book has now had been returned. They've been doing that for years. It's a very efficient system. It's interesting to note that apparently every library is different. In other words, since I get my books from Kentucky, the Louisville Talking Book Library, as far as I understand it, a certain title there might have a different barcode than a library somewhere else. So supposedly they each have made their own databases, although I'm not absolutely sure of that. But it is kind of interesting to think that talking books have barcodes. Another place that has barcodes, that uses barcodes all the time, is the post office. In fact, I believe in Word, Microsoft Word, you can actually print a barcode on your envelope, which, as far as I know, is a zip code, probably the 9-digit zip code. Sometimes when you get free matter, they put little stickers. I'm not sure the whole purpose of that, but if you can scan those little peel-off stickers, and that'll have several digits of your zip code as a barcode. And many books have their own barcode, different types of barcode that has the title and author of the book. Most barcodes that I'm familiar with are actually decode into numbers. The UPC Type A barcodes are 11 digits long plus a checksum digit. And the purpose of that checksum digit is to validate the code. In other words, there's a formula that any barcode scanning program has that it uses the first 11 digits of the code to compute a checksum digit. And if the 12th digit does not agree with what the computer thinks it should, then it's considered an invalid code. So it's a way of ensuring consistency of your data. Well, some more about barcodes. I found it very difficult to get a product database of barcodes. It's almost like it's intellectual property. I know you can purchase databases. I mean, that's what supermarkets do. They have a database of barcodes, products, and you know, prices. I've checked all over on the web, and I probably I found some miscellaneous data, and there's probably about 800 products that I ship data on with bscan.zip. I have no idea how accurate they are or how current they are, but every now and then when I scan something, it does actually know what it is, even though I haven't typed it in myself. So again, the normal barcode is 12 digits long. The first 11 digits are the actual code, and the last one is the checksum digit. The first, I believe, six numbers of this code indicate the manufacturer's type. So supposedly you can tell the manufacturer from just that code, and the other leftover digits identify the product. So there's a huge number of digits available, and it's unlikely that anybody's going to run out of barcodes anytime soon. And I'm not sure the name of it, but there are actually, you know, barcode organizations. There are standards that have been set to assign these manufacturer types, and then once that has been assigned, the manufacturer's code, whatever, then they can give their product whatever number they want. So, running the program, what you do is you you first have to install your QCAT by unplugging your keyboard, plugging it into the computer, and then plugging your keyboard back into the little pigtail. You can actually get keyboard extensions, the keyboard cord extensions, extension cords, so that you can, if it's not long enough, you can have plenty of room to do whatever you need to do with your QCAT. And like I say, if it's not in use, you can just lay it down on the table or the desk. It's not going to interfere with your keyboard. So to install the program, what you do is you unzip it to a scratch directory. And the files you actually need to copy somewhere on your path are bscan.exe, bscan.txt, and bscanman.txt. And of course there's a readme.txt file you should definitely read. The bscan.txt file is a database containing all previously scanned products. If you look at the file, you can read it with a normal text editor. It has the barcode, either 7 or 12 digits usually, followed by a space and then the name of the product. And as long as the line, I believe, is less than 80 columns, you can put whatever you want in the product. The other file, bscanman.txt, is a database of manufacturers. So it's possible that the program might think it knows the manufacturer, but it still doesn't know the product, because manufacturers, you know, obviously can make more than one product. But I felt that even if you didn't know exactly what the product was, knowing who the manufacturer was would be useful information to have. Now, the bscan.txt and bscanman.txt have to be in the same directory as bscan.exe. That's where the program looks for them. So if you put them somewhere else, the program's not going to be able to find them. Okay, so I have DOS, of course, on my machine, and I will explain how to use the program from Windows in a little while here. Okay, we're going to type in bscan.
Scan, enter barcode, colon.
And you get the enter barcode prompt. Well, there are a couple ways of entering barcodes. You can actually enter the encrypted barcode, which is pretty impractical. It was mostly left in there for debugging purposes and so forth. And it will convert it to a barcode. You can scan a barcode with a QCAT barcode reader, which is going to be as if you had typed these encrypted digits and letters from your keyboard. Or you can actually enter the barcode itself. Anytime you have a barcode, I believe it's below the barcode, it could be above, but somewhere above or below the barcode is a printed are the printed digits that the barcode represents. So it's possible that the QCAT will not scan the barcode correctly. That is a little bit of a problem. It could be a contrast problem, not enough contrast. There could be a dirt or something on the can or whatever product you want to scan. Occasionally, it's not doesn't always happen, but occasionally you will not be able to scan a barcode. So it can be a problem because, for one thing, you may not actually know where a barcode is supposed to be, and then even if you know where it is, it may not scan properly. There are ways to figure out where barcodes are, usually, if you do it enough. For example, on cans, you can usually, if the cans are stackable, that is, if they have a bottom to them, you can only open them from the top, and so you know what the orientation of the can is supposed to be. And the barcode's usually around a half inch from the bottom, somewhere near the seam, so you can put the seam right near the lens of the QCAT and rotate the can around the seam, and do that a few times, and you usually will get a proper scan. But if you don't get a scan and you still want to enter the barcode in your data, you can actually type in the 12-digit barcode, and it will interrogate the database. The database, like I say, is a text file, so it's every time you do a scan, it's going to go through these 1,000 entries. So if you had a huge database, you know, there could be you might have to wait a few seconds. But the chances of having a large database like that, since it's so difficult to get a listing of what products are what, are remote, and for the average person, this will be plenty good enough. Anyway, as a demonstration, I have some cans here. I have 3 cans that I know scan. I don't know exactly what they are. I know what one is, and I don't know what the other two are. What happens is she buys me a bunch of cans. The wife buys a bunch of cans that I like. It could be ravioli, could be such and such. And I have a place for them so that when she's not here and I want a can, I can just, I'm kind of like a dog or a cat. I really don't care what it is. It's in a can and I'll eat it. So it's not like I'm going to open up a can of condensed milk when I want a fruit cocktail or something like that. So I haven't been terribly concerned as to what the products are. Anyway, I have 3 cans here, so we're at the enter barcode prompt. You can always hit escape at any time, and you can get out of the program.
Separator done.
You're back to the DOS prompt. I'll type in bscan again.
Scan, enter barcode, colon.
You can type in just garbage. You can type in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 0, 1, 2.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0, 1, 2. This manufacturer is not in your database, period. Enter manufacturer, colon.
Well, that was kind of a bad example because apparently the checksum that I wanted to point out the fact that if you just typed in 12 random digits, it probably would not, the checksum digit would not be correct. So it just happened to be that that apparently is correct, and it's asking me for a manufacturer. So the program doesn't really care whether you type the barcode in from the keyboard or swipe it using the QCAT. So I don't want to enter that. That's just garbage data. So if you press enter,
this product is not in your database period. Enter product description colon.
It'll skip the manufacturer. It has not entered anything in the database, and you can just press enter again.
Enter barcode colon.
And it's not entered anything in the product database. So you haven't really ruined anything. So I'll go ahead and actually get a can. Like I say, I don't know what it is. Put it on the computer table here. It's one of these stackable cans, so I know what the can orientation is supposed to be. And we'll just scan it here.
Period C3NZ3NZ3NXPHK1DHD1CXNX period FHMC period C3B3CNP3C3D2PXVX period. This manufacturer is not in your database period. Enter manufacturer colon.
Now those that kind of garbage in the beginning was actually the encrypted form of the barcode. And the reason you heard that, I believe, is because keyboard echo is on. If I turned it off, you might not hear that. So I don't know what the manufacturer of this can is. One of the things you can do is just make something up so that when you find out, you can always, you know, save the can later. I don't like to scan things that I've already opened because I don't want any food to get into anything. It's kind of messy, so I don't like to do that. But I can always do it after the fact if I really care to. So I can put main menu if I want.
Main menu chicken parmesan. Enter barcode colon.
Well, that's obviously wrong. It knew who the product was. It was chicken parmesan, but it didn't know who the manufacturer was, so that's kind of silly here. So we'll get another can. And let's see here.
Period C3NZ3NZ3NXPHK1DHD1CXNX period FHMC period C3B3CNP3C3DWCHD0 period manufacturer colon main menu. This product is not in your database period. Enter product description colon.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Whatever it is, whatever this can is, it has the same manufacturer as the last one, which we don't know. So it figured out that we put a main menu in it. So I'll just type in something silly like
Chili. Enter barcode colon.
I typed in ACB chili. So we'll get another can here. And we'll scan away here.
Period C3NZ3NZ3NXDHK1DHD1CXNX period FHMC period C3B3CNP3C3DXCNF7 period manufacturer colon main menu. This product is not in your database period. Enter product description colon.
I'll put in ACB corn, let's say.
ACB corn. Enter barcode colon.
I'll scan that can again. Just for something to do here.
Period C3NZ3NZ3NXDHK1DHD1CXNX period FHMC period C3B3CNP3C3DXCNF7 period manufacturer colon main menu ACB form enter barcode colon.
And just for completeness, I'll go ahead and scan another can. One of the earlier ones, I don't even remember what it is.
Period C3NZ3NZ3NXDHK1DHD1CXNX period FHMC period C3B3CNP3C3D2PXVX period manufacturer colon main menu chicken parmesan enter barcode colon.
Okay, well, I guess that's enough of that. I'll go ahead and press enter since I don't want to enter any more barcodes.
C greater than.
You'll notice that any valid barcode decrypted by the QCAT reader will start with a period. In fact, as I remember, a period separates the different segments. There's a serial number segment, there's a code segment, there's a revision segment. It's actually quite interesting if you do a Google search on the website of the person who cracked it. Now you can go ahead and edit that database if you don't like any of those product names, or you later want to go back and fix it. You can just use your word processor. It's going to be at the end of the data, so just go down to the bottom of the file and find the entry you want to change and change it, and then save the file. So there's nothing wrong with putting product names if you're not exactly sure what they are. You can always go back and change them. And I just happen to have a talking book here. I'll even tell you what the... Okay. It's number 42292. I'll go ahead and scan it. And this is what happens. I'll start B scan again.
Scan, enter PowerPoint colon. Cyprian, 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 XDHK1, DHD1, CXN, X, period, out, 6, period, Cyprian, ZCX, D2, period, barcode type equals Cyprian, barcode equals 07024531, enter barcode colon.
So what happens there, since the program didn't know what to do with that barcode type, every barcode has a type. I don't know if the program knows every single barcode type there is, but it's calling it type C39. I'm sure that has some significance. And that seems to be the type of all talking books that have barcodes. And then since it didn't know what it wasn't going to add them to your product database. It just gave you what the barcode was. And this probably has no meaning except for the library in Kentucky here. So now I'll do a short demonstration of how to use the program in Windows. It's still a DOS program, so you're going to have the same limitations you do if you don't have a speech hardware synthesizer. So I'll go ahead and I'll exit out of there, and then I'll exit back to Windows. Now, I have a shortcut set up, I believe. Alt Control B for B scan, so I'll go ahead and start that.
Menu closed, button start, scan.
And you don't hear anything, but on the screen it's going to say enter barcode. So I'll go ahead and do that. I can find my can here. Huh, that was interesting. Okay, I think that's the beep you hear, or the noise you want to hear. I think we got the car horn beep because I had accidentally pressed another key or something, and it didn't think it was a valid barcode. So now using the mouse review keys, you're still in Windows. The DOS program is finished. You can use your mouse review keys.
Auto. Grab it. Enter. Code. Enter. Manufacturer main menu. Chip and power resin.
So then we can go ahead and close that window with Alt F4.
Desktop. List new. RAM. 28 of 30. Start menu. Menu closed. Button. Start. MS-DOS ROM ports. See greater than.
And we can go back to DOS if you want. So that's about it for the B-Scan program. I hope this gives you an idea of what barcodes can be used for. They're very useful. I always thought that maybe a solution to the paper currency problem would be to put barcodes on U.S. bills. I think they are already on Canadian bills. And, the QCAT reader is by no means the perfect solution. You have to be very careful where you put the thing to do a scan. It's not impossible, but you could get frustrated and impatient. And so if someone can come up with a better scanner, it'd be very useful. So, this is Randy Fermenti from Louisville, Kentucky, and if you have any other questions about this program, you can email me at n8kl@mindspring.com.
I rented my apartment on a Monday at 1, I'm singing to Lolly Lolly Shaky Bum Shaky Bum. Started moving in it on a Tuesday at 2, I'm singing to Lolly Lolly Shaky Do Shaky Do. Wednesday at 3, I called the phone company, singing, hey baby, put a phone in for me. Thursday at 4, he came a-knocking at my door, singing, hey baby, I'm your telephone man, won't you show me where you want it and I'll put it where I can. I can put it in the bed.
Hello, this is Dane Trethown from Nelson, Victoria, Australia, and today I'd like to say a few words about a new facility which I think you'll find useful if you're in Australia, and certainly if you're in other countries you may wish to check with your relevant telephone companies to see if you can get a similar service. The service I'd like to talk to you about today is called Telstra Home Communicate Prepay, and what this essentially does is turns your home telephone into a credit phone rather than a debit phone. So let's run a scenario past you. You talk away on the phone and you don't particularly know how many calls you've made during a month until the bill comes, and you have to rely on what the bill tells you, plus your extra charges for your rent, your equipment and other stuff, other facilities that your phone company may offer you that you may be subscribed to, all of which can add up to a fairly hefty amount. And then you can ring the phone company and say to them, look, I didn't make these calls. And the phone company says to you, well, you did, the bill says so, and that's the end of the question, so pay up or we chop your phone off and we take you to court. Now, there's a way of avoiding all that. And of course, actually, I didn't think of this at the time when I got the service, that it makes the phone accessible or more accessible to blind people than it ever has been before. I mean, you think about the printed bills you get. If you don't have a scanner, you can't read them at all. And even if you do have a scanner, sometimes they don't make any sense because of the way they're laid out. Okay, Braille bills are around, but I've had a Braille bill in the past from my phone company in Australia, Telstra, and the Braille bill arrives a couple of days before the bill is due, and that may be highly inconvenient for some people. Okay, you can pay your bill online, but if you don't have an internet connection, what do you do? And there are still, unfortunately, a lot of people who do not have that facility at their disposal. Okay, so I got sick of the phone bills, the Braille bills, and got sick of me having no recourse, pay up or no argument, the phone gets cut off. So I had a look around and thought I'd give this Home Communicate Prepay a go and see what it was like. And I've had it for just over 2 weeks now, and I'm mightily impressed with it. Unfortunately, Telstra don't seem to want to advertise good services that they offer. They seem to be, how shall we say, suffering from a PR problem. Their image is a bad one of not failing to comply with service guarantees and all this sort of thing, and treating people rather badly and overcharging and all that. So, oh, well, I'll give them a good plug and try this service. All right, so what happens? It's different to the normal service. When you pick up the phone, you do not get a dial tone as you normally would. Rather, you get an announcement, and let's hear that now, and you'll have to bear with me because I have a hands-free phone, and it's not a terribly good one, so it may mute out from time to time, but let's see how we go.
Welcome to Communicate Prepaid Home. Please enter your account number and PIN, followed by the hash key.
All right, well, we'll do that. Here we go.
In your account, you currently have $28.90. Please enter the number you wish to call, followed by the hash key.
For further options, press 00#.
Okay, let's go to the options menu and see what you're offered.
To recharge your account, press 11#. To hear your last 10 transactions, press 12#. To access your voicemail, press 13#. To hear your available credit, press 14#. To change your PIN, press 15#. To direct calls to your home phone, press 21#. To direct calls to your mobile, press 23#. To direct calls to your voicemail, press 25#. For help, press 99#. To hear these options again, press 00#. Or enter the number you wish to call, followed by the hash key.
Well, as you can hear, we've got quite a diverse range of options there. So let's dial my message bank number, leave a message, and we'll find out a little more about how the service works. Here we go. What is it? 0500 500 571 and hash or pound if you're living in the States.
Hi, this is Dane. I cannot talk to you right now, so you may leave a message and I will get back to you as soon as I can. Thank you for calling.
Yes, okay, we're doing a demonstration of the Telstra Home Communicate prepaid service for main menu. And that should be enough for a message, don't you think? So we'll leave this message now and press the hash key.
Message sent. Goodbye. In your account, you currently have $28.70. Please enter the number you wish to call, followed by the hash key.
All right, well, we'll go to the options menu and go and see what the voicemail is doing.
To recharge your account, press 11#. To hear your last 10 transactions, press 12#. To access your voicemail, press 13#. To hear your available credit, press 14#. To change your PIN, press...
Okay, we'll press 13# and see what happens here.
You have one new voice message. Message received at 10:18 a.m. today.
It's okay, we're doing a demonstration of the Telstra Home Communicate prepaid service for main menu. And that should be enough for a message, don't you think? So we'll leave this message now and press the hash key.
To replay message, press 1. To delete, press 5.
Okay, we'll delete it. We don't need that anymore.
Message deleted. There are no more messages.
And to exit this, we press 99.
Goodbye. You have voicemail. In your account, you currently have $28.50.
All right, well, I think we've done enough with that. So as you can hear, when every call is hung up, your credit is announced again, so you can keep a very good running record of what you've used. And, of course, you can go through the last 10 transactions. I myself often go through those and write any major ones down for STD calls, etc. Interestingly, STD rates for this service are capped at $2.50 between 7 p.m. and midnight weeknights and between 4 p.m. and midnights on weekends. Local calls are capped at 11 cents on a Saturday, and as you heard just then, local calls at every other time are 20 cents. So quite reasonable rates, considering that you're only paying around about $12 per month for the service, $5 extra if you want the message bank voicemail service. Your usual facilities are available, call waiting, and of course you have the call diversion options, as you would have heard. So if this service interests you and you're in Australia, contact Telstra on 13 2200 and follow the voice prompts. They now have a voice activated service rather than a touch tone button service. And follow the prompts, and you can be put through to the appropriate section to organise your connection to Telstra Home Prepaid Communicate, or Communicate Prepay, whatever it's called. There's also a service for mobile too. Okay, that about wraps it up. Thank you for that. If you'd like to give me an email and have any questions about this service, do that. You can email me at grtdane@tft-bbs.com. That's grtdane@tft-bbs.com. And catch you on the phone.
Well, it's time for Main Menu to log off for another week. Thanks for your company. Don't forget to visit us on the web at allthews.acbradio.org/mainmenu.html.